Terminus. It was obvious enough now they saw it. This was what happened when a chaotic retreat could go no further. It only took a moment to adjust. He saw thousands of men, 10, 20,000, perhaps more, spread across the vastness of the beach. In the distance, they were like grains of black sand. But there were no boats, apart from one upturned whaler rolling in the distant surf. It was low tide and almost a mile to the water's edge. There were no boats by the long jetty. He blinked and looked again. That jetty was made of men, a long file of them, 6 or 8 deep, standing up to their knees, their waists, their shoulders, stretching out for 500 yards through the shallow waters. They waited, but there was nothing in sight, unless you counted in those smudges on the horizon, boats burning after an air attack. There was nothing that could reach the beach in hours. But the troops stood there, facing the horizon in their tin hats, rifles lifted above the waves. From this distance, they looked as placid as cattle. And these men were a small proportion of the total. The majority were on the beach, moving about aimlessly. Little clusters had formed around the wounded left by the last Stuka attack. As aimless as the men, half a dozen artillery horses galloped in a pack along the water's edge. A few troops were attempting to right the upturned whaler. Some had taken off their clothes to swim. Off to the east was a football game, and from the same direction came the feeble sound of a hymn being sung in unison, then fading. Beyond the football game was the only sign of official activity. On the shore, lorries were being lined up and lashed together to form a makeshift jetty. More lorries were driving down. Nearer, up the beach, individuals were scooping sand with their helmets to make foxholes. In the dunes, close to where Turner and the corporal stood, men had already dug themselves holes, from which they peeped out, proprietorial and smug. Like marmosets, he thought. But the majority of the army wandered about the sands without purpose, like citizens of an Italian town in the Yar of Passeggio. They saw no immediate reason to join the enormous queue, but they were unwilling to come away from the beach in case a boat should suddenly appear. To the left was the resort of Bray, a cheerful front of cafes and little shops that in a normal season would be renting out beach chairs and pedal bikes. In a circular park with a neatly mowed lawn was a bandstand and a merry-go-round painted red, white and blue. In this setting, another, more insouciant company had hunkered down. Soldiers had opened up the cafes for themselves and were getting drunk at the tables outside, bawling and laughing. Men were larking about on the bikes along a pavement stained with vomit. A colony of drunks was spread out on the grass by the bandstands, sleeping it off. A solitary sunbather in his underpants, face down on a towel, had patches of uneven sunburn on his shoulders and legs, pink and white like a strawberry and vanilla ice cream.
This ends Disc 8. Atonement, Disc 9.
It was not difficult to choose between these circles of suffering, the sea, the beach, the front. The corporals were already walking away. Thirst alone decided it. They found a path on the landward side of the dunes, then they were crossing a sandy lawn strewn with broken bottles. As they were making a way round the raucous tables, Turner saw a naval party coming along the front and stopped to watch. There were 5 of them, 2 officers, 3 ratings, a gleaming group of fresh white, blue and gold. No concessions to camouflage. Straight-backed and severe, revolvers strapped to their belts, they moved with tranquil authority through the mass of sombre battle dress and grimy faces, looking from side to side as if conducting a count. One of the officers made notes on a clipboard. They headed away toward the beach. With a childish feeling of abandonment, Turner watched them until they were out of sight. He followed Mace and Nettle into the din and fumy stench of the first bar along the front. Two suitcases, propped open on the bar, were full of cigarettes, but there was nothing to drink. The shelves along the sandblasted mirror behind the bar were empty. When Nettle ducked behind the counter to rummage around, there were jeers. Everyone coming in had tried the same. The drink had long gone with the serious drinkers outside. Turner pushed through the crowd to a small kitchen at the back. The place was wrecked. The taps were dry. Outside was a pissoir and stacked crates of empties. A dog was trying to get its tongue inside an empty sardine can, pushing it across a patch of concrete. He turned and went back to the main room and its roar of voices. There was no electricity, only natural light which was stained brown, as though by the absent beer. Nothing to drink, but the bar remained full. Men came in, were disappointed, and yet they stayed, held there by free cigarettes and the evidence of recent booze. The dispensers dangled empty on the wall, where the inverted bottles had been wrenched away. The sweet smell of liquor rose from the sticky cement floor. The noise and press of bodies and damp tobacco air satisfied a homesick yearning for a Saturday night pub. This was the Mile End Road and Sockey Hall Street, and everywhere in between. He stood in the din, uncertain what to do. It would be such an effort to fight his way out of the crowd. There were boats yesterday, he gathered from a snatch of conversation, and perhaps again tomorrow. Standing on tiptoe by the kitchen doorway, he gave a no-luck shrug across the crowd toward the corporals. Nettle cocked his head in the direction of the door, and they began to converge on it. A drink would have been fine, but what interested them now was water. Progress through the press of bodies was slow, and then, just as they converged, their way to the door was blocked by a tight wall of backs forming around one man. He must have been short, less than 5'6", and Turner could see nothing of him apart from a portion of the back of his head. Someone said, "You answer the fucking question, you little git." "Yeah, go on then." "Oi, brill cream job. Where was you? Where were you when they killed my mate?" A globule of spittle hit the back of the man's head and fell behind his ear. Turner moved round to get a view. He saw first the grey-blue of a jacket and then the mute apprehension in the man's face. He was a wiry little fellow with thick, unclean lenses in his glasses which magnified his frightened stare. He looked like a filing clerk or a telephone operator, perhaps from a headquarters long ago dispersed. But he was in the RAF, and the Tommies held him accountable. He turned slowly, gazing at the circle of his interrogators. He had no answers to their questions, and he made no attempt to deny his responsibility for the absence of Spitfires and Hurricanes over the beach. His right hand clutched his cap so hard his knuckles trembled. An artilleryman standing by the door gave him a hard push in the back so that he stumbled across the ring into the chest of a soldier, who sent him back with a casual punch to the head. There was a hum of approval. Everyone had suffered, and now someone was going to pay. "So where's the RAF?" A hand whipped out and slapped the man's face, knocking his glasses to the floor. The sound of the blow was precise as a whip crack. It was a signal for a new stage, a new level of engagement. His naked eyes shrank to fluttering little dots as he went down to grope around his feet. That was a mistake. A kick from a steel-capped army boot caught him on the backside, lifting him an inch or two. There were chuckles all round. A sense of something tasty about to happen was spreading across the bar and drawing more soldiers in. As the crowd swelled around the circle, any remaining sense of individual responsibility fell away. A swaggering recklessness was taking hold. A cheer went up as someone stubbed his cigarette on the fellow's head. They laughed at his comic yelp. They hated him, and he deserved everything that was coming his way. He was answerable for the Luftwaffe's freedom of the skies, for every Stuka attack, every dead friend. His slight frame contained every cause of an army's defeat. Turner assumed there was nothing he could do to help the man without risking a lynching himself. But it was impossible to do nothing. Joining in would be better than nothing. Unpleasantly excited, he strained forward. Now a tripping Welsh accent proposed the question. "Where's the RAF?" It was eerie that the man had not shouted for help or pleaded or protested his innocence. His silence seemed like collusion in his fate. Was he so dim that it had not occurred to him that he might be about to die? Sensibly, he had folded his glasses into his pocket. Without them, his face was empty. Like a mole in bright light, he peered around at his tormentors, his lips parted, more in disbelief than in an attempt to form a word. Because he could not see it coming, he took a blow to the face full on. It was a fist this time. As his head flipped back, another boot cracked into his shin, and a little sporting cheer went up, with some uneven applause, as though for a decent catch in the slips on the village green. It was madness to go to the man's defence. It was loathsome not to. At the same time, Turner understood the exhilaration among the tormentors and the insidious way it could claim him. He himself could do something outrageous with his Bowie knife and earn the love of 100 men. To distance the thought, he made himself count the 2 or 3 soldiers in the circle he reckoned bigger or stronger than himself. But the real danger came from the mob itself, its righteous state of mind. It would not be denied its pleasures. A situation had now been reached in which whoever threw the next hit had to earn general approval by being ingenious or funny. There was an eagerness in the air to please by being creative. No one wanted to strike a false note. For a few seconds, these conditions imposed restraint. And at some point soon, Turner knew from his Wandsworth days, the single blow would become a cascade. Then there would be no turning back, and for the RAF man, only one end. A pink blotch had formed on the cheekbone under his right eye. He had drawn his fist up under his chin. He was still gripping his cap, and his shoulders were hunched. It may have been a protective stance, but it was also a gesture of weakness and submission which was bound to provoke greater violence. If he had said something, anything at all, the troops surrounding him might have remembered that he was a man, not a rabbit to be skinned. The Welshman who had spoken was a short, thick-set fellow from the sappers. He now produced a belt of canvas webbing and held it up. "What do you think, lads?" His precise, insinuating delivery suggested horrors that Turner could not immediately grasp. Now was his last chance to act. As he looked around for the corporals, there was a roar from close by like the bellowing of a speared bull. The crowd swayed and stumbled as mace barged through them into the circle. With a wild, hollering, yodeling sound, like Johnny Weissmuller's Tarzan, he picked up the clerk from behind in a bear hug, lifting him 18 inches clear of the ground, and shook the terrified creature from side to side. There were cheers and whistles, foot stamping and Wild West whoops.
"I know what I want to do with him," Mace boomed. "I want to drown him in the bloody sea."
In response, there rose another storm of hooting and stamping. Nettle was suddenly at Turner's side and they exchanged a look. They guessed what Mace was about and they began to move toward the door, knowing they would have to be quick. Not everyone was in favour of the drowning idea. Even in the frenzy of the moment, some could still recall that the tide line was a mile away across the sands. The Welshman in particular felt cheated. He was holding up his webbing and shouting. There were catcalls and boos as well as cheers. Still holding his victim in his arms, Mace rushed for the door. Turner and Nettle were ahead of him, making a path through the crowd. When they reached the entrance, usefully a single, not a double door, they let Mace through, then they blocked the way, shoulder to shoulder, though they appeared not to, for they were shouting and shaking their fists like the rest. They felt against their backs a colossal and excited human weight, which they could only resist for a matter of seconds. This was long enough for Mace to run, not toward the sea, but sharp left and left again, up a narrow street that curved behind the shops and bars, away from the front. The exultant crowd exploded from the bar like champagne, hurling Turner and Nettle aside. Someone thought he saw Mace down on the sands, and for half a minute the crowd went that way. By the time the mistake was realised and the crowd began to turn back, there was no sign of Mace and his man. Turner and Nettle had melted away too. The vast beach, the thousands waiting on it, and the sea empty of boats, returned the Tommies to their predicament. They emerged from a dream. Away to the east, where the night was rising, the perimeter line was under heavy artillery fire. The enemy was closing in, and England was a long way off. In the failing light, not much time remained to find somewhere to bed down. A cold wind was coming in off the channel, and the greatcoats lay on the roadsides far inland. The crowd began to break up. The RAF man was forgotten. It seemed to Turner that he and Nettle had set out to look for Mace and then forgot about him. They must have wandered the streets for a while, wanting to congratulate him on the rescue and share the joke of it. Turner did not know how he and Nettle came to be here in this particular narrow street. He remembered no intervening time, no sore feet. But here he was, addressing in the politest terms an old lady who stood in the doorway of a flat-fronted terraced house. When he mentioned water, she looked at him suspiciously, as though she knew he wanted more than water. She was rather handsome, with dark skin, a proud look and a long, straight nose, and a floral scarf was tied across her silver hair. He understood immediately she was a gypsy who was not fooled by his speaking French. She looked right into him and saw his faults, and knew he'd been in prison. Then she glanced with distaste at Nettle, and at last pointed along the street to where a pig was nosing around in the gutter. "Bring her back," she said, "and I'll see what I have for you." "Fuck that," Nettle said once Turner had translated. "We're only asking for a cup of bloody water. We'll go in and take it." But Turner, feeling a familiar unreality taking hold, could not discount the possibility that the woman was possessed of certain powers. In the poor light, the space above her head was pulsing to the rhythm of his own heart. He steadied himself against Nettle's shoulder. She was setting him a test he was too experienced, too wary to refuse. He was an old hand. So close to home, he was not falling for any traps. Best to be cautious. "We'll get the pig," he said to Nettle. "It'll only take a minute." Nettle was long used to following Turner's suggestions, for they were generally sound. But as they went up the street, the corporal was muttering, "There's something not right with you, Governor." Their blisters made them slow. The sow was young and quick and fond of her freedom. And Nettle was frightened of her. When they had it cornered in a shop doorway, she ran at him and he leaped aside with a scream that was not all self-mockery. Turner went back to the lady for a length of rope, but no one came to the door and he wasn't certain that he had the right house. However, he was certain now that if they did not capture the pig, they would never get home. He was running a temperature again, he knew, but that did not make him wrong. The pig equaled success. As a child, Turner had once tried to persuade himself that preventing his mother's sudden death by avoiding the pavement cracks outside his school playground was a nonsense. But he had never trodden on them, and she had not died. As they advanced up the street, the pig remained just beyond their reach.
Fuck it, Nettle said. We can't be doing with this.
But there was no choice. By a fallen telegraph pole, Turner cut off a length of cable and made a noose. They were pursuing the sow along a road on the edge of the resort where bungalows were fronted by small patches of gardens surrounded by fences. They went along, opening every front gate on both sides of the street. Then they took a detour down a side road in order to get round the pig and chase it back the way it had come. Sure enough, it soon stepped into a garden and began rooting it up. Turner closed the gate and, leaning over the fence, dropped the noose over the pig's head. It took all their remaining strength to drag the squealing sow back home. Fortunately, Nettle knew where it lived. When it was finally secure in the tiny sty in her back garden, the old woman brought out two stone flagons of water. Watched by her, they stood in bliss in her little yard by the kitchen door and drank. Even when their bellies seemed about to burst, their mouths craved more, and they drank on. Then the woman brought them soap, flannels, and two enamel bowls to wash in. Turner's hot face changed the water to rusty brown. Scabs of dried blood moulded to his upper lip came away satisfyingly whole. When he was done, he felt a pleasing lightness in the air around him which slipped silkily over his skin and through his nostrils. They tipped the dirty water away onto the base of a clump of snapdragons, which Nettle said made him homesick for his parents' back garden. The gypsy filled their canteens and brought them each a litre of red wine, with the corks half pulled, and a saucisson which they stowed in their haversacks. When they were about to take their leave, she had another thought and went back inside. She returned with two small paper bags, each containing half a dozen sugared almonds. Solemnly, they shook hands. "For the rest of our lives, we will remember your kindness," Turner said. She nodded, and he thought she said, "My pig will always remind me of you." The severity of her expression did not alter, and there was no telling whether there was insult or humour or a hidden message in her remark. Did she think they were not worthy of her kindness? He backed away awkwardly, and then they were walking down the street and he was translating her words for Nettle. The corporal had no doubts.
"She lives alone, and she loves a pig. Stands to reason. She's very grateful to us."
Then he added suspiciously,
"Are you feeling all right, Governor?"
"Extremely well, thank you." Troubled by their blisters, they limped back in the direction of the beach with the idea of finding Mace and sharing the food and drink. But having caught the pig, Nettle thought it was fair dues to crack open a bottle now. His faith in Turner's judgment had been restored. They passed the wine between them as they went along. Even in the late dusk, it was still possible to make out the dark cloud over Dunkirk. In the other direction, they could now see gun flashes. There was no let-up along the defence perimeter.
"Those poor bastards," Nettle said.
Turner knew he was talking about the men outside the makeshift orderly room. He said,
"The line can't hold much longer." "We'll be overrun."
"So we'd better be on a boat tomorrow." Now they were no longer thirsty. Dinner was on their minds. Turner was thinking of a quiet room and a square table covered with a green gingham cloth, with one of those French ceramic oil lamps suspended from the ceiling on a pulley, and the bread, wine, cheese and saucisson spread out on a wooden board. He said, "I'm wondering if the beach would really be the best place for dinner."
"We could get robbed blind," Nettle agreed.
"I think I know the kind of place we need." They were back in the street behind the bar. When they glanced along the alley they had run down, they saw figures moving in the half-light, outlined against the last gleam of the sea, and far beyond them to one side, a darker mass, that may have been troops on the beach, or dune grass, or even the dunes themselves. It would be hard enough to find Mace by daylight, and impossible now. So they wandered on, looking for somewhere. In this part of the resort now there were hundreds of soldiers, many of them in loud gangs drifting through the streets, singing and shouting. Nettle slid the bottle back into his haversack. They felt more vulnerable without Mace. They passed a hotel that had taken a hit. Turner wondered if it was a hotel room he had been thinking of. Nettle was seized by the idea of dragging out some bedding. They went in through a hole in the wall and picked their way through the gloom, across rubble and fallen timbers, and found a staircase. But scores of men had the same idea. There was actually a queue forming up at the bottom of the stairs, and soldiers struggling down with heavy horsehair mattresses. On the landing above, Turner and Nettle could just see boots and lower legs moving stiffly from side to side. A fight was developing, with wrestling grunts and a smack of knuckles on flesh. Following a sudden shout, several men fell backward down the stairs onto those waiting below. There was laughter as well as cursing, and people were getting to their feet and feeling their limbs. One man did not get up, but lay awkwardly across the stairs, his legs higher than his head and screaming hoarsely, almost inaudibly, as though in a panicky dream. Someone held a lighter to his face, and they saw his bared teeth and flecks of white in the corners of his mouth. He had broken his back, someone said, but there was nothing anyone could do, and now men were stepping over him with their blankets and bolsters, and others were jostling to go up. They came away from the hotel and turned inland again, back toward the old lady and her pig. The electricity supply from Dunkirk must have been cut, but round the edges of some heavily curtained windows they saw the ochre glow of candlelight and oil lamps. On the other side of the road soldiers were knocking at doors, but no one would open up now. This was the moment Turner chose to describe to Nettle the kind of place that he had in mind for dinner. He embellished to make his point, adding French windows open onto a wrought-iron balcony through which an ancient wisteria threaded, and a gramophone on a round table covered by a green chenille cloth, and a Persian rug spread across a chaise longue. The more he described, the more certain he was that the room was close by. His words were bringing it into being. Nettle, his front teeth resting on his lower lip in a look of kindly rodent bafflement, let him finish and said, "I knew it. I fucking knew it." They were standing outside a bombed house, whose cellar was half open to the sky and had the appearance of a gigantic cave. Grabbing him by his jacket, Nettle pulled him down a scree of broken bricks. Cautiously, he guided him across the cellar floor into the blackness. Turner knew this was not the place, but he could not resist Nettle's unusual determination. Ahead, there appeared a point of light, then another, and a third. The cigarettes of men already sheltering there. A voice said, "Get it, bugger off, we're full!" Nettle struck a match and held it up. All around the walls there were men, propped in a sitting position, most of them asleep. A few were lying in the centre of the floor, but there was still room, and when the match went out, he pressed down on Turner's shoulders to make him sit. As he was pushing debris away from under his buttocks, Turner felt his soaked shirt. It may have been blood or some other fluid, but for the moment there was no pain. Nettle arranged the greatcoat around Turner's shoulders. Now the weight was off his feet, an ecstasy of relief spread upward through his knees, and he knew he would not move again that night, however disappointed Nettle might be. The rocking motion of day-long walking transferred itself to the floor. Turner felt it tilt and buck beneath him as he sat in total darkness. The problem now was to eat without being set upon. To survive was to be selfish. but he did nothing for the moment and his mind emptied. After a while, Nettle nudged him awake and slipped the bottle of wine into his hands. He got his mouth around the opening, tipped the bottle and drank. Someone heard him swallowing.
"What's that you got?"
"Sheep's milk," Nettle said. "Still warm. Have some."
There was a hawking sound and something tepid and jelly-like landed on the back of Turner's hand.
"You're filthy, you are."
Another voice, more threatening, said, "Shut up, I'm trying to sleep." Moving soundlessly, Nettle groped in his haversack for the saucisson, cut it into three, and passed a piece to Turner with a chunk of bread. He stretched out full length on the concrete floor, pulled his greatcoat over his head to contain the smell of the meat, as well as the sound of his chewing, and in the fug of his own breathing, and with pieces of brick and grit pressing into his cheek, began to eat the best meal of his life. There was a smell of scented soap on his face. He bit into the bread that tasted of army canvas and tore and sucked at the sausage. As the food reached his stomach, a bloom of warmth opened across his chest and throat. He had been walking these roads, he thought, all his life. When he closed his eyes, he saw moving asphalt and his boots swinging in and out of view. Even as he chewed, he felt himself plunging into sleep for seconds on end. He entered another stretch of time, and now, lying snugly on his tongue, was a sugared almond, whose sweetness belonged to another world. He heard men complaining of the cold in the cellar, and he was glad of the coat tucked around him, and felt a fatherly pride that he had stopped the corporals throwing theirs away. A group of soldiers came in looking for shelter and striking matches, just as he and Nettle had. He felt unfriendly toward them and irritated by their West Country accents. Like everyone else in the cellar, he wanted them to go away. But they found a place somewhere beyond his feet. He caught a whiff of brandy and resented them more. They were noisy, organizing their sleeping places, and when a voice from along the wall called out,
"Fucking yokels!"
One of the newcomers lurched in that direction, and for a moment it seemed there would be a rumble. But the darkness and the weary protests of the residents held the peace. Soon there were only the sounds of steady breathing and snores. Beneath him the floor still seemed to list, then switched to the rhythm of a steady march. And once again, Turner found himself too afflicted by impressions, too fevered, too exhausted to sleep. Through the material of his coat, he felt for the bundle of her letters. "I'll wait for you. Come back." The words were not meaningless, but they didn't touch him now. It was clear enough. One person waiting for another was like an arithmetical sum, and just as empty of emotion. Waiting. Simply one person doing nothing over time while another approached. Waiting was a heavy word. He felt it pressing down, heavy as a greatcoat. Everyone in the cellar was waiting, everyone on the beach. She was waiting, yes. But then what? He tried to make her voice say the words, but it was his own he heard, just below the tread of his heart. He could not even form her face. He forced his thoughts toward the new situation, the one that was supposed to make him happy. The intricacies were lost to him. The urgency had died. Bryony would change her evidence. She would rewrite the past so that the guilty became the innocent. But what was guilt these days? It was cheap. Everyone was guilty, and no one was. No one would be redeemed by a change of evidence, for there weren't enough people, enough paper and pens, enough patience and peace to take down the statements of all the witnesses and gather in the facts. The witnesses were guilty too. All day we've witnessed each other's crimes. You killed no one today. But how many did you leave to die?
down here in the cellar, we'll keep quiet about it. We'll sleep it off, Bryony.
His sugared almond tasted of her name, which seemed so quaintly improbable that he wondered if he had remembered it correctly. Cecilia's, too. Had he always taken for granted the strangeness of these names? Even this question was hard to hold for long. He had so much unfinished business here in France that it seemed to him sensible to delay his departure for England, even though his bags were packed, his strange, heavy bags. No one would see them if he left them here and went back. Invisible baggage. He must go back and get the boy from the tree. He had done it before. He had gone back, where no one else was, and found the boys under a tree and carried Pierrot on his shoulders and Jackson in his arms across the park. So heavy. He was in love with Cecilia, with the twins, with success and the dawn and its curious glowing mist. And what a reception party. Now he was used to such things, a roadside commonplace. But back then, before the coarsening and general numbness, when it was a novelty and when everything was new, he felt it sharply. He cared when she ran out across the gravel and spoke to him by the open police car door. Oh, when I was in love with you, then I was clean and brave. So he would go back the way he had come, walk back through the reverses of all they had achieved, across the drained and dreary marshes, past the fierce sergeant on the bridge, through the bombed-up village and along the ribbon road that lay across the miles of undulating farmland, watching for the track on the left, on the edge of the village, opposite the shoe shop, and 2 miles on, go over the barbed wire fence and through the woods and fields to an overnight stop at the brothers' farm, and next day, in yellow morning light on the swing of a compass needle, hurry through that glorious country of little valleys and streams and swarming bees, and take the rising footpath to the sad cottage by the railway. And the tree. Gather up from the mud the pieces of burned striped cloth, the shreds of his pyjamas, then bring him down, the poor pale boy, and make a decent burial. A nice-looking kid. Let the guilty bury the innocent, and let no one change the evidence. And where was Mace to help with the digging? That brave bear, Corporal Mace. Here was more unfinished business, and another reason why he could not leave. He must find Mace. But first he must cover the miles again and go back north to the field where the farmer and his dog still walked behind the plough and ask the Flemish lady and her son if they held him accountable for their deaths. For one can assume too much sometimes in fits of conceited self-blame. She might say no, the Flemish for no. You tried to help us. You couldn't carry us across the field. You carried the twins, but not us, no. No, you are not guilty. No. There was a whisper, and he felt the breath of it on his burning face.
Too much noise, Governor.
Behind Corporal Nettle's head was a wide strip of deep blue sky, and etched against it the ragged black edge of the cellar's ruined ceiling.
Noise? What was I doing?
Shouting no and waking everyone up. Some of these lads was getting a bit peeved.
He tried to lift his head and found that he couldn't. The corporal struck a match.
Christ, you look fucking terrible. Come on, drink.
He raised Turner's head and put the canteen to his lips. The water tasted metallic. When he was done, a long, steady, oceanic swell of exhaustion began to push him under. He walked across the land until he fell in the ocean. In order not to alarm Nettle, he tried to sound more reasonable than he really felt.
Look, I've decided to stay on. There's some business I need to see to.
With a dirty hand, Nettle was wiping Turner's forehead. He saw no reason why Nettle should think it necessary to put his face, his worried, ratty face, so close to his own. The corporal said,
"Governor, can you hear me? Are you listening? About an hour ago, I went out for a slash. Guess what I saw? There was the Navy coming down the road, putting out the call for officers. They're getting organised on the beach. The boats are back. We're going home, mate. There's a lieutenant from the Buffs here who's marching us down at 7. So get some sleep and no more of your bloody shouting."
He was falling now, and sleep was all he wanted. 1,000 hours of sleep. It was easier. The water was vile, but it helped, and so did the news and Nettle's soothing whisper. They would be forming up in the road outside and marching to the beach, squaring off to the right. Order would prevail. No one at Cambridge taught the benefits of good marching order. They revered the free, unruly spirits, the poets. But what did the poets know about survival? About surviving as a body of men? No breaking ranks, no rushing the boats, no first come, first served, no devil take the hindmost. No sound of boots as they cross the sand to the tide line. In the rolling surf, willing hands to steady the gunwale as their mates climbed in. But it was a tranquil sea, and now that he himself was calm, of course he saw how fine it really was that she was waiting. Arithmetic be damned.
"I'll wait for you,"
was elemental. It was the reason he had survived. It was the ordinary way of saying she would refuse all other men. "Only you. Come back." He remembered the feel of the gravel through his thin-soled shoes. He could feel it now, and the icy touch of the handcuffs on his wrists. He and the inspector stopped by the car and turned at the sound of her steps. How could he forget that green dress, how it clung to the curve of her hips and hampered her running and showed the beauty of her shoulders? Whiter than the mist. It didn't surprise him that the police let them talk. He didn't even think about it. He and Cecilia behaved as though they were alone. She would not let herself cry when she was telling him that she believed him, she trusted him, she loved him. He said to her simply that he would not forget this, by which he meant to tell her how grateful he was, especially then, especially now. Then she put a finger on the handcuffs and said she wasn't ashamed, there was nothing to be ashamed of. She took a corner of his lapel and gave it a little shake, and this was when she said,
"I'll wait for you. Come back."
She meant it. Time would show she really meant it. After that, they pushed him into the car, and she spoke hurriedly before the crying began that she could no longer hold back. And she said that what had happened between them was theirs, only theirs. She meant the library, of course. It was theirs. No one could take it away. "It's our secret," she called out in front of them all, just before the slam of the door.
"I won't say a word," he said,
though Nettle's head had long disappeared from his view.
"Wake me before 7. I promise you won't hear another word from me."
Part 3. The unease was not confined to the hospital. It seemed to rise with the turbulent brown river swollen by the April rains, and in the evenings lay across the blacked-out city like a mental dusk which the whole country could sense, a quiet and malign thickening, inseparable from the cool late spring, well concealed within its spreading beneficence. Something was coming to an end. The senior staff, conferring in self-important groups at the corridor intersections, were nursing a secret. Younger doctors were a little taller, their stride more aggressive, and the consultant was distracted on his round, and on one particular morning crossed to the window to gaze out across the river for minutes on end, while behind him the nurses stood to attention by the beds and waited. The elderly porters seemed depressed as they pushed the patients to and from the wards, and seemed to have forgotten their chirpy catchphrases from the wireless comedy shows, and it might even have consoled Bryony to hear again that line of theirs she so despised. "Cheer up, love. Might never happen." But it was about to. The hospital had been emptying slowly, invisibly, for many days. It seemed purely chance at first, an epidemic of good health that the less intelligent of the trainees were tempted to put down to their own improving techniques. Only slowly did one detect a design. Empty beds spread across the ward and through other wards, like deaths in the night. Bryony imagined that retreating footsteps in the wide polished corridors had a muffled, apologetic sound, where once they had been bright and efficient. The workman, who came to install new drums of fire hose on the landings outside the lifts and set out new buckets of firefighting sand, laboured all day without a break and spoke to no one before they left, not even the porters. In the ward, only 8 beds out of 20 were occupied, and though the work was even harder than before, a certain disquiet and almost superstitious dread prevented the student nurses from complaining when they were alone together at tea. They were all generally calmer, more accepting. They no longer spread their hands to compare chilblains. In addition, there was the constant and pervasive anxiety the trainees shared about making mistakes. They all lived in fear of Sister Marjory Drummond, of the menacing meagre smile and softening of manner that preceded her fury. Bryony knew she had recently accumulated a string of errors. 4 days ago, despite careful instruction, a patient in her care had quaffed her carbolic gargle, according to the porter who saw it, down in one like a pint of Guinness, and was violently sick across her blankets. Bryony was also aware that she had been observed by Sister Drummond carrying only 3 bedpans at a time, when by now they were expected to go the length of the ward reliably with a pile of 6, like a busy waiter at La Coupole. There may have been other errors, too, which she would have forgotten in her weariness, or never even known about. She was prone to errors of deportment. In moments of abstraction, she tended to shift her weight onto one foot in a way that particularly enraged her superior. Lapses and failures could carelessly accrue over several days. A broom improperly stowed, a blanket folded with its label facing up, a starched collar in infinitesimal disarray, the bedcasters not lined up and pointing inward, walking back down the ward empty-handed, all silently noted until capacity was reached, and then, if you had not read the signs, the wrath would come down as a shock. And just when you thought you were doing well. But lately the sister was not casting her mirthless smile in the direction of the probationers, nor speaking to them in the subdued voice that gave them such terrors. She hardly bothered with her charges at all. She was preoccupied, and often stood in the quadrangle by men's surgical in long conferences with her counterpart, or she disappeared for 2 days at a time. In another context, a different profession, she would have seemed motherly in her plumpness or even sensual, for her unpainted lips were rich in natural colour and sweetly bowed, and her face with its rounded cheeks and doll's patches of healthy pink suggested a kindly nature. This impression was dispelled early on when a probationer in Bryony's year, a large, kindly, slow-moving girl with a cow's harmless gaze, met the lacerating force of the ward sister's fury. Nurse Langland had been seconded to the men's surgical ward and was asked to help prepare a young soldier for an appendectomy. Left alone with him for a minute or two, she chatted and made reassuring remarks about his operation. He must have asked the obvious question, and that was when she broke the hallowed rule. It was set out clearly in the handbook, though no one had guessed how important it was considered to be. Hours later, the soldier came round from his anaesthetic and muttered the student nurse's name while the surgical ward sister was standing close by. Nurse Langland was sent back to her own ward in disgrace. The others were made to gather round and take careful note. If poor Susan Langland had carelessly or cruelly killed 24 patients, it could not have been worse for her. By the time Sister Drummond finished telling her that she was an abomination to the traditions of Nightingale nursing to which she aspired, and should consider herself lucky to be spending the next month sorting soiled linen, not only Langland but half the girls present were weeping. Bryony was not among them, but that night in bed, still a little shivery, she went through the handbook again to see if there were other points of etiquette she might have missed. She reread and committed to memory the commandment, "In no circumstances should a nurse communicate to a patient her Christian name." The wards emptied, but the work intensified. Every morning the beds were pushed into the centre so that the probationers could polish the floor with a heavy bumper that a girl on her own could barely swing from side to side. The floors were to be swept 3 times a day. Vacated lockers were scrubbed, mattresses fumigated, brass coat hooks, doorknobs and keyholes were buffed. The woodwork, doors as well as skirting, was washed down with carbolic solution, and so were the beds themselves, the iron frames as well as springs. The students scoured, wiped and dried bedpans and bottles till they shone like dinner plates. Army 3-ton lorries drew up at the loading bays, bringing yet more beds, filthy old ones that needed to be scrubbed down many times before they were carried into the ward and squeezed into the lines, and then carbolized. Between tasks, perhaps 12 times a day, the students scrubbed their cracked and bleeding chilblained hands under freezing water. The war against germs never ceased. The probationers were initiated into the cult of hygiene. They learned that there was nothing so loathsome as a wisp of blanket fluff hiding under a bed, concealing within its form a battalion, a whole division of bacteria. The everyday practice of boiling, scrubbing, buffing and wiping became the badge of the student's professional pride, to which all personal comfort must be sacrificed. The porters brought up from the loading bays a great quantity of new supplies, which had to be unpacked, inventoried, and stowed. Dressings, kidney bowls, hypodermics, 3 new autoclaves, and many packages marked bunion bags, whose use had not yet been explained. An extra medicine cupboard was installed and filled, once it had been scrubbed 3 times over. It was locked, and the key remained with Sister Drummond. But one morning, Bryony saw inside rows of bottles labelled morphine. When she was sent on errands, she saw other wards in similar states of preparation. One was already completely empty of patients and gleamed in spacious silence, waiting. But it was not done to ask questions. The year before, just after war was declared, the wards on the top floor had been closed down completely as a protection against bombing. The operating theatres were now in the basement. The ground floor windows had been sandbagged and every skylight cemented over. An army general made a tour of the hospital with 6 consultants at his side. There was no ceremony or even silence when they came. Usually, on such important visits, so it was said, the nose of every patient had to be in line with the centre creasing of the top sheet. But there was no time to prepare. The general and his party strode through the ward, murmuring and nodding, and then they were gone. The unease grew. but there was little opportunity for speculation, which in any case was officially forbidden. When they were not on their shifts, the probationers were in lessons in their free time, or lectures, or at practical demonstrations, or studying alone. Their meals and bedtimes were supervised as if they were new girls at Rodine. When Fiona, who slept in the bed next to Bryony, pushed her plate away and announced to no one in particular that she was clinically incapable of eating vegetables boiled with an OXO cube, the Nightingale home sister stood over her until she had eaten the last scrap. Fiona was Bryony's friend, by definition. In the dormitory, on the first night of preliminary training, she asked Bryony to cut the fingernails of her right hand, explaining that her left hand couldn't make the scissors work and that her mother always did it for her. She was ginger-haired and freckled, which made Bryony automatically wary. But unlike Lola, Fiona was loud and jolly, with dimples on the backs of her hands and an enormous bosom which caused the other girls to say she was bound to be a ward sister one day. Her family lived in Chelsea. She whispered from her bed one night that her father was expecting to be asked to join Churchill's war cabinet. But when the cabinet was announced, the surnames didn't match up and nothing was said, and Bryony thought it better not to inquire. In those first months after preliminary training, Fiona and Bryony had little chance to find out if they actually liked each other. It was convenient for them to assume they did. They were among the few who had no medical background at all. Most of the other girls had done first aid courses, and some had been VADs already, and were familiar with blood and dead bodies, or at least they said they were. But friendships were not easy to cultivate. The probationers worked their shifts in the wards, studied 3 hours a day in their spare time, and slept. Their luxury was tea time between 4 and 5, when they took down from the wooden slatted shelves their miniature brown teapots inscribed with their names and sat together in a little day room off the ward. Conversation was stilted. The home sister was there to supervise and ensure decorum. Besides, as soon as they sat down, tiredness came over them, heavy as three-folded blankets. One girl fell asleep with a cup and saucer in her hand and scalded her thigh. A good opportunity, Sister Drummond said, when she came in to see what the screaming was about, to practice the treatment of burns. And she herself was a barrier to friendship. In those early months, Bryony often thought that her only relationship was with Sister Drummond. She was always there, one moment at the end of a corridor, approaching with a terrible purpose, the next at Bryony's shoulder, murmuring in her ear that she had failed to pay attention during preliminary training to the correct procedures for blanket-bathing male patients. Only after the second change of washing water should the freshly soaped back flannel and back towel be passed to the patient so that he could finish off for himself. Bryony's state of mind largely depended on how she stood that hour in the ward sister's opinion. She felt a coolness in her stomach whenever Sister Drummond's gaze fell on her. It was impossible to know whether you had done well. Bryony dreaded her bad opinion. Praise was unheard of. The best one could hope for was indifference. In the moment she had to herself, usually in the dark, minutes before falling asleep, Bryony contemplated a ghostly parallel life in which she was at Girton reading Milton. She could have been at her sister's college rather than her sister's hospital. Bryony had thought she was joining the war effort. In fact, she had narrowed her life to a relationship with a woman 15 years older who assumed a power over her greater than that of a mother over an infant. This narrowing, which was above all a stripping away of identity, began weeks before she had ever even heard of Sister Drummond. On her first day of the 2 months preliminary training, Bryony's humiliation in front of the class had been instructive. This was how it was going to be. She had gone up to the sister to point out courteously that a mistake had been made with her name badge. She was B. Tallis, not, as it said on the little rectangular brooch, N. Tallis. The reply was calm. You are, and will remain, as you have been designated. Your Christian name is of no interest to me. Now kindly